Let's move on to introducing our speakers today. And I say they're just incredibly eminent, and I'm so delighted that they're both with us today. I'm really looking forward to hearing what they've got to say, but also, the questions and answers afterwards. So, Dr. Adi Cooper, OBE, Independent Chair of two Safeguarding Adults Board in London, and she's the Care and Health Improvement Advisor for London for the Local Government Association, the Lead for Adult Safeguarding, and a Visiting Professor at the University of Central Bedfordshire. Qualified social worker, social work manager, and she's done an awful lot in the areas of professional development, service improvement, Care Act, guidance, particularly in relation to adult safeguarding, and particularly developing the Making Safeguarding Personal program. So that's AD. So we have Michael Preston Shute, Professor Emeritus of Social Work at the University of Bedfordshire, Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences and a Senior Fellow at the Higher Education Academy. And his research focuses on adult safeguarding, and he's carried out major studies for Department of Health with Susie Brave and David Orr on effective practice with adults who self-neglect and safeguarding governance, hugely important issues, and currently working on sector-led improvement projects on adult safeguarding and homelessness, and again on Making Safeguarding Personal for health and social care commissioners and providers. So, you know, incredible speakers, and really, you know, honoured that they're with us here today. So they're both going to talk. I think AD's going to start first, then we'll go straight to Michael. And I think they're both going to talk about things through different lenses. The current data, you know, I think in some ways we feel that safeguarding is kind of different since COVID, since the pandemic. And it's not that we think the issues are different. I think we all feel that the pandemic has spotlighted those things that we already knew were there, and those injustices and inequalities and that testimonial injustice. But what I think is difficult for us all as practitioners is that we don't have that face-to-face now that we used to do. And that feels quite difficult because, you know, having a Zoom conversation with somebody in a care home or whatever setting, you know, we can have that dialogue if they're able to engage with that, but we can't see or we can't feel if the room's cold or get a sense of, you know, the bedding or those kind of things. So, you know, in some ways everything's the same, but in some ways lots of things are different since the pandemic. So Adi and Michael are going to share current research, but from looking at it through really different lenses. So I'm going to hand over to Adi now. But as I say, keep questions coming through the chat function, but best to wait till you've heard both of them before submitting questions, because I think there's a chance that they could have been answered. So thank you. Over to Adi.
Thank you. So hopefully, thanks for that introduction, Judith, and I'm really pleased to see everybody here this afternoon, and it's great that this is being put on during Safeguarding Adults Awareness Week. Can somebody put the slides up? So I'm going to talk to some slides. Thanks, Frances. And I'm going to talk about a piece of work that I've been involved with in my role at the Care and Health Improvement Programme. And this is a piece of work that we're calling the Insight Project. And I've been doing it with a couple of colleagues there, but also with loads and loads of people across the country. Can you hear me clearly enough, Judith? Is that fine?
Yes, it's perfect. Thank you.
So So if we have the first slide, and I'll talk about why we did this piece of work. So what we were trying to understand was what was going on with safeguarding adults' activity during the COVID-19 pandemic. There is information collected from local authorities every year, but it's done at the end of the year and it's reported several months later. So for example, information that came, would have come through up until March this year, so 2020, will not be published until later on November, December this year. And what was happening after March, so from April, we wouldn't be able to see that until next year. So we knew that there wasn't going to be any national mechanism for collecting that information through the normal ways through NHS Digital. And yet lots of people wanted to know what was going on because maybe they knew what was happening in their very own locality, but they had no idea what was happening more regionally or more nationally. So what we asked people to do was to send us their information on what was going on a voluntary basis, and what they thought was happening in their areas. So it was both quantitative data, so numbers, but also qualitative, that's their impressions, their understanding, what they thought, what they were worried about, what they saw was going on. And why did we do this? Partly because, as I say, we didn't know, there wasn't a mechanism that to tell us what was happening. There were lots of worries about the impact of COVID-19, the pandemic itself, but also the responses to the pandemic, the lockdown. People were really very worried that different types of safeguarding risks were exacerbated, were increased. And also, really importantly, and this is fundamental to the Care and Health Improvement Programme, we wanted to learn. The Care Improvement Programme is a sector-led improvement programme. It's about trying to understand what's going on in order to learn lessons and do things differently. And in particular, it was the chairs and managers of safeguarding adult boards who said, please, can we help try to find out what's going on at a national level? And we were very lucky that the local government association have a mechanism, a tool called LG Inform that helps us to bring that information together. So if you go to the next slide, it tells you a bit about what we did. So what we asked people to send us was their activity data. So the information on what happened in safeguarding from the previous year. So from January, going back to January 2019, so that we could then compare, say January in 2019 with January 2020, March 2020 with March 2019. So we could see year on year, what was the difference, because that would give us some sense of what the impact of COVID and the lockdown might be. This is a bit technical, but for those of you who know about this, we used a subset of the Safeguarding Adult collection that did NHS Digital use. So that's the statutory data collection on safeguarding that has been going on for the last few years. We used something called an Excel template, so it was fairly easy for people to put the information in. And we had this system at LG Inform that could put it together. And we also pulled together the comments that they made. Now, we had lots of caveats about this information because there were so many variations in terms of what was going on locally. And in particular, the data hasn't been validated. So it's like rough cut data. We also know that there's been some changes in practice between those 2 years in terms of how things are counted. And so we knew that that might have some impact on what people told us. So that's what we did, that's how we did it, but we knew that there were these sorts of issues around collecting this information. If you can go to the next slide, what this shows you what was that 92 councils gave us their information and insight, which is over 60% of the English councils. And I have to say, this is for me staggering, given how much pressure everybody's been under during this year, the response rate was absolutely fantastic. And people were really generous in terms of providing the information. So just about half also gave us additional information, including some qualitative insights And this table gives you a breakdown of the regions, the 9 different ADAS regions, of the variation in how many responses we got. So it was quite variable over the country, but as a total, 60% of councils gave us their information, which is fantastic. So if we go to the next slide, I'll move on to what we found out. So what this line shows, and it's the rate of concerns that are reported per 100,000. So it's a rate, it's not a number, it's a rate. And it shows that month on month, going back to January 2019, there's a certain amount of variation. But very clearly, what happened at the very beginning of the lockdown was there's a drop. And that was reinforced by what people were saying, was that as the lockdown started, there was a real drop in the concerns, safeguarding concerns that were being reported. But what we can also see on this graph is that there was a bounce back. And the bounce back went even higher than previous levels of concerns during the year. So that was something that there is a fairly clear pattern regarding. If you move on to the next slide, you can see what happens with the Section 42 safeguarding inquiries. So these are those concerns where further inquiries are necessary under the Act. And this is the data that's collected every year in the safeguarding ad hoc collection. And you can see a similar pattern. It goes up and down, but there is a very clear drop at the beginning of the lockdown, and then there's an upturn in May and June, but it's not as large as the safeguarding concerns in terms of that increase back. So what we also know is it takes time. So a concern that's reported, it may take some time for an inquiry to be made under Section 42, and so one of the pieces of feedback that we got from this first stage of the programme is people said to us, it's too soon to say what's happening, and really we need to continue to collect this information to find out what happened over the rest of the summer, and I'll come back to that at the end. But that's the overall pattern of what happened. And then if you look at the next slide, hopefully people can see this. We asked about what types of abuse were being reported, and it's a bit tricky to see, but in summary, there wasn't any really significant change in the types of abuse being reported, although psychological abuse, self-neglect and domestic abuse do seem to be slightly higher during that lockdown period, which also correlates to what people thought was happening, particularly that when people were in their own homes during the lockdown, that there was a higher level of self-neglect. We know from the national reporting to domestic abuse helplines that domestic abuse was being reported more. So in some sense, this kind of confirms what we thought. But interestingly, it's only slightly higher. It's not as dramatic as people feared that in terms of the data that's been collected through the safeguarding systems. On the next page, you've got the same information, but it's in a bar chart rather than in a line. And that really just reinforces that the differences in the types of abuse being reported are marginal, but there are some significant differences. Some slightly higher overall differences around those three areas of psychological, domestic abuse and self-neglect. So moving on to the second side, this is quite interesting in terms of the location of abuse. So there was a substantial increase in the frequency of abuse reported in somebody's own home, and that's the blue bars, and a matching decrease in the frequency of reporting from care home, that's both residential and nursing-based inquiries. And I think that reinforces a lot of people's impressions that with the care homes closing their doors, there was a much lower level of reporting of safeguarding issues through to the local authorities. But it's reflected in an increase and a decrease rather than in any other way. So that's the pattern of location that is different during this period of time. Moving on to the next slide, this is trying to summarise what we found out that people told us in their responses, not in the numbers, but in what they told us. And some people wrote a paragraph and some people gave us 3 pages of information. There was a very varied response from the 45 people or local authorities that talked to us. And these were the types of things that they were telling us changed during the pandemic. So first of all, there was a number of local authorities that said there was an increase in what we could describe as anxiety referrals. So referrals often from the blue light services, so emergency services, that were very worried about individuals. But a number of those referrals, those concerns didn't become safeguarding inquiries because they were more about more general issues about people being in there during the COVID pandemic and issues that are arising. So they were about anxious and fearful situations, but not necessarily about what we would describe as safeguarding issues. And support was offered and they were responded to, but not through necessarily a safeguarding response. I've already talked a bit about the location of abuse and that shift in terms of people not seeing as many referrals, as many concerns from people in institutional settings, and the increase of referrals from people in their own homes. There was also a slight decrease in reporting from people in healthcare settings as well. I haven't provided, there are more graphs in the detailed report about this difference between the reporting of concerns and the inquiries for people over the age of 65 and under the age of 65. So that red blob, which says demographics, is really a reference to the fact that there were some differences in terms of age range, which is one of the issues we asked for. In the full set of returns, there are more details about gender, for example, but we didn't ask for that information because we were trying to make this information collection as least onerous as possible. So we didn't ask for a lot of detail, but there is definitely some difference around age range. Several authorities said to us they changed their recording methods. And so recording methods did have some impact in that local system. And that's what we had said when we started this project, and people told us, yes, we've changed how we record things and that will impact on the information that you get. We've put in the R rate or the reproduction rate, and I think it's just acknowledging that there are factors in what we've called the ecosystem of a council during COVID-19 in relation to safeguarding, that certainly looking at the summer months as well and moving on into the winter now, how COVID impacts in an area may also be part of a variable. We can't give any evidence of that, but if we ignore, you know, it feels right not to ignore it and to mention it as a potential factor. So there are some areas in England who've been under lockdown for most of this year, and there are others that haven't. So that reproduction rate and the R rate and the impact on local circumstances must have something, some impact, but we don't yet know what it is. The technology and innovation, one of the things we also ask people to tell us about is what they've done differently in response to COVID and the lockdown. And there are some examples in the report of some really innovative practice, both in terms of use of technology, but also in terms of prevention and proactive initiatives that local partners developed to respond to these very unusual and challenging circumstances that we all found ourselves in with the lockdown in response to COVID. And a lot of that involved partnership working. So these bubbles coming up the left-hand side of this diagram are to allude to those different types of factors that really impacted on the way people responded to the challenges of COVID pandemic and the lockdown in response. And the final thing I would just like to comment on this is that there was some reflection back in the information, the insight people were giving us, that inquiries were more complex. The sorts of things that people were reporting were maybe a bit more severe and more complex. that's not evidenced in the data, but that is more evidenced in what people were telling us about what they were seeing. And in a couple of cases, they'd done some deep dives or some more detailed analysis of safeguarding casework to understand what was going on. And this was one of the things that they fed back to us had changed. So moving on to my last slide, just to tell you what we're doing next. So we've produced a report that those slides have taken the information from, which is about to be published online. But people, if people want it before then, please ask me and I can send it to them, because we've circulated the final draft pending having it on an online version at the LGA. We've sent out reports to all the participants, which gives them their local data against regional and national data. So local boards and partnerships can look at what's happened and think about whether there's anything useful to do in response to that. And we're about to circulate a new pro forma with some different questions to ask for information following that period from July till December this year, so that we can see what happened next over the next 6 months and look at being able to report and describe at a national level sometime during early next year, the narrative as it continued through the pandemic over this summer and through the autumn into the winter. So although at the beginning there was a certain reluctance to support this program because people thought that it was going to be quite burdensome, actually during the course of doing it, there's been a surprisingly high level of support for the project, and certainly some support for continuing it, which I think is an indicator of people finding it useful to ask us to do to continue the project, to be able to produce a second report next year to describe the pattern of safeguarding activity over this period of time. So Judith, I'm going to end there and pass over to Michael about another piece of work, but then we can come back to the questions at the end.
Yes, perfect. Thank you.
Right, well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to be presenting the findings of a project that in fact AD commissioned and indeed oversaw. And it's a project that we have recently finished, and we are beginning to disseminate the findings. The project involves an analysis of safeguarding adult reviews, reviews that were completed by safeguarding adult boards between April 2017 and March 2019. So obviously the reviews that we were looking at in order to learn lessons for sector-led improvement, that is the enhancement of services across the board, took place before the pandemic. So what I'll try to do at various points is to tease out what I think the implications of the findings are for what we are all experiencing at the moment. And I will highlight in particular the findings that emerged on advocacy from the analysis of the reviews, and we can then explore the degree to which those findings resonate with your experience of providing and or receiving advocacy currently. Okay, next slide, please, Francis.
It seems to have paused temporarily, so I am... Oh, sorry. There we go. Is that the first one, or have we skipped one? Have we skipped one, Michael?
No, we haven't skipped one. No, that's all right. So this is a case of travelling, hopefully, isn't it? So there we go. So this slide merely tells you that AD Cooper commissioned and oversaw the project through to completion, and that it was commissioned by the Care and Health Improvement Programme, for which AD is the adult safeguarding lead, and the programme is co-produced by the Local Government Association and the Association of Directors of Adult Social Services in England. And there is a report and an executive summary. At the moment, we have a pre-publication version of the report, but on or around the 14th of December, the Local Government Association website will have a published version that will be available online and hopefully also available in a PDF format to download if you are interested. If you haven't got a copy of the report and are particularly interested in having it now rather than when it becomes available in published form on the 14th of December, then let me know. Okay, next slide, please. So what I'm going to do today is to present the findings, particularly on advocacy, from the review of 231 Safeguarding Adult Reviews, to identify some priorities in relation to improving and enhancing services across the different agencies involved in adult protection, adult safeguarding, and that obviously includes organisations commissioned to provide advocacy, and in the time available to answer as many of your questions as it's possible to do. Next slide, please, Francis. So, in summary form, we sent out a request to the 132 safeguarding adult boards that currently exist in England. And we did that actually as the pandemic took hold and the lockdown commenced, lockdown one commenced. So just as Aidy was saying how positive she thought the response was for her project, I can be even more pleased that we had a 98% response from Safeguarding Adult Boards. 129 of the 132 responded by providing copies of or details of both published Safeguarding Adult Reviews, but also importantly, unpublished Safeguarding Adult Reviews. And because we also searched different websites and different libraries for reviews, we are very confident that we have a complete sample of reviews, which total 231. And we've analysed the data both quantitatively as well as quantitatively. So we can count the numbers of different types of abuse and neglect, for example, the numbers of men and women who were the focus of reviews and so forth. We can count the numbers both nationally in England, but also regionally. And the qualitative analysis enables us to identify themes about good practice, themes about poor practice, and themes within recommendations. And we can organize that around the individual themselves, in line with making safeguarding personal, really focusing in on the individual and their wishes, hopes, desired outcomes, as well as needs of care and support. And then the team around the person, which obviously sometimes will include an advocate, the organisations supporting the team around the person, and then ultimately the safeguarding adult board role in overseeing all of it. And all of this, of course, takes place in a national context, the national context being set by government in Westminster. And if the pandemic shows anything at all, it shows that our governmental response sometimes is positive and sure-footed. And in relation to people experiencing homelessness, we have seen what political ambition and financial investment can achieve through the Everybody In initiative to take homeless people off the streets and find accommodation for them in the midst of lockdown one. But we have also seen a government that is less than sure-footed when it comes to the social care sector generally and the care home sector within social care sector specifically, and the very real struggles there were to get PPE and testing and tracing for residents in care homes. And those struggles, of course, have not gone away, with concerns about the impact for people in care homes of not having contact with family members. Okay, next slide, please, Francis. This simply tells you what I've just already said, in fact, which is the analytic framework to identify themes of good practice, poor practice, and recommendations, starting with the focus on the adult at the centre of our concerns, in line with making safeguarding personal, and then moving out through the team around the person, the organisation supporting the team around the person, the oversight from safeguarding adult boards, and then the legal, policy, and financial context within which all of this is located. Next slide, please, Francis. There are two sets of findings, and I will talk about advocacy in relation to each of them. Two sets of findings from our review of the 231 reviews. One set of findings is about the governance of safeguarding adult reviews, how they're commissioned, how they're managed, how they're delivered, how they're disseminated, and the role of advocacy within that. And the second set of findings is, well, what emerges from the 231 cases in terms of how effectively or otherwise adults were protected from abuse and neglect, how well or otherwise did services work together, and what's the influence of the national context within which all of this is located. So I'll present some thoughts in relation to each of those sets of findings. Next slide, please, Francis. So in relation to the safeguarding adult review process, there are some key findings and some key questions that emerge with specific reference to the role of advocates and advocacy. The majority of the individuals who were the focus of safeguarding adult reviews had in fact died. 80% of them had passed away. And actually that replicates what we know from other analyses of safeguarding adult reviews. But that, clearly that left 20% of cases where the adult was still alive. And in six of those cases, the individual and or the individual's family members were supported by an advocate to participate in the safeguarding adult review process itself. And I regard that as an important role for advocates to support the individual, to speak their truth to the services that were surrounding them at the time they were experiencing abuse and neglect. But perhaps it is salutary to note that there were only six cases where that happened. And that maybe the role of advocates and advocacy organisations needs to be strengthened in relation to the SAR process. There were occasions where a key worker, so a practitioner rather than an independent advocate, acted as an advocate to assist somebody to engage in the SAR process. And I think that raises again the question that has no doubt been debated before and will be debated again about the distinction between independent advocacy and advocacy being provided by either a family member or indeed a paid practitioner. And those of you listening to this may have some thoughts about that. Where an individual was involved or where family members were involved in a SAR process, the extent of their involvement varied. But perhaps one example stands out for me from my reading of the 231 reviews. And that was where an independent mental capacity advocate supported an individual who had survived quite traumatic abuse and neglect to write their own account of what they had experienced, to put together a presentation for the Safeguarding Adult Board and the panel overseeing the Safeguarding Adult review process, to make that presentation, to deliver that presentation at a learning event, and then to comment on the report that was produced subsequently. It's an example that shows what is possible when there is imagination and creativity and support provided to enable a person to engage meaningfully in a process. Sadly, there were examples where advocacy should have been considered and was not. In other words, where an individual had survived abuse and neglect, but where the terms for the commissioning of an advocate in the mental capacity legislation, mental health legislation, Care Act legislation, where the criteria were clearly met, but where advocacy was not considered. There were also occasions where an advocate was requested, but where the whole process was delayed because there were insufficient advocates in the area concerned. And that raises questions, which again, you may wish to comment on in relation to the sufficiency of supply of advocates in the areas that you are familiar with. Next slide, please, Francis. So moving on from the SAR processes itself to what emerges from the 231 cases, you'll see that in 28% of the cases, so 64, there was specific reference to advocacy, and I will identify in a number of slides in a moment exactly what those references referred to. So 28% of the cases touched on advocacy to a greater or lesser extent. 263 people involved in the 231 cases, and as I've noted, in 80% of the cases, the adult had in fact passed away, sometimes as a direct result of abuse and neglect, including self-neglect, sometimes for reasons that were not associated with abuse and neglect, but were because of other causes, for example, significant physical health concerns. And then where gender was identified, slightly more men than women, that's again quite a common finding when we've looked at safeguarding adult reviews. Very little information about sexuality or ethnicity, and I consider that both of those are significant omissions that actually need to be rectified by safeguarding adult boards and safeguarding adult review authors going forward. It is not acceptable to not consider the impact of sexuality and ethnicity, race and culture, on how cases were understood, how practitioners sought to involve, respond to, relate to the needs of the people that they were working with. Significant evidence of trauma and loss and bereavement, the impact of adverse experiences on individuals' lives. You cannot understand a person in the here and now, as I'm sure those of you who are advocates recognize, without actually understanding the person's journey. What has happened at different points in a person's life will profoundly impact and affect how they see the world in the here and now, and whether they have sufficient resilience with or without support from advocates and others to manage their life challenges in the here and now. And I am absolutely in no doubt that how we are all responding to lockdown two and the virus is in no small way affected by experiences we've had in our life journey to this point. You'll also see the number of occasions where people were living in group care settings, the number of occasions where the location of abuse was a care setting alongside those cases where people were living in their own home. And because, as you will see in a moment, self-neglect was quite prominent in the sample that we had, you will see that self-neglect focuses here. The number of perpetrators that were listed as self was in fact just under 10%. But again, in line with all of our concerns at the moment about what is going on in care homes, you'll see that care providers in just under a third of cases were noted to be the perpetrators of abuse, either through neglect and omission or indeed organisational systemic abuse, the likes of which we've seen in places like Winterbourne View, Waltron Hall, Orchid View and other places. Next slide, please, Francis. So we were able to calculate the number of reviews that focused on different types of abuse and neglect. You may recall that AD noted that in the Insight project, there was a slight increase, not uniformly across England, but a slight increase in particular places in the number of safeguarding referral concerns on self-neglect. But here you've got self-neglect as the number one type of abuse or neglect that was focused on in the 231 reviews. Significantly, perhaps for advocates in the room, in their roles in relation to care homes, but equally in other settings, neglect and omission was the second most prominent type of abuse and neglect, and organisational abuse, the fourth most prominent. But one of the things we noted through the reviews was that it was not always clear whether the type of abuse or neglect being focused on was the result of an individual practitioner getting something seriously wrong, or whether what the practitioner had or had not done was evidence of wider organisational and systemic problems that needed to be addressed. Domestic abuse focused explicitly in 22 cases, but sometimes domestic abuse was classed rather as physical abuse, financial abuse, psychological abuse, or sexual abuse. So in fact, the number of cases of domestic abuse was higher than the number of cases formally registered as domestic abuse. There were a number of cases of hate crime and mate crime, but very few of those cases were classed as discriminatory abuse. Somebody who is abused on account of their ethnicity, on account of their disabilities, on account of their sexuality is, in my book, a victim of discriminatory abuse, and it should be recorded as such. Next slide, please, Francis. So what are the findings and what were the recommendations in relation to advocacy? So the notable findings on advocacy on the left-hand side of the slide as I look at it is that all too frequently advocacy is not considered. So whether this is because practitioners and managers are unclear about the circumstances where an advocate must be considered within Mental Health Act legislation, Mental Capacity Act legislation, Care Act legislation, domestic violence provisions, domestic abuse provisions, whether it is that people are not legally literate in that sense, or whether for some other reason there were far too many cases where the review was reporting that advocacy was not considered and should have been. Alternatively, however, and perhaps more positively, some good advocate practice was recorded. Advocates clearly understanding their roles, their remits, their responsibilities, and clearly exercising those responsibilities and roles with the person they were the advocate for. There were occasions when advocacy was provided, but sometimes exceedingly late in a mental capacity assessment process or a Care Act process or a domestic abuse case, for example. And going back to my comments about whether the supply of advocacy in particular areas is adequate and sufficient, there were examples of a waiting list for advocacy, which was delaying the completion of assessments, reviews, or other types of decision making. There were some cultural barriers noted, by which I mean resistance within service providers to engage with and respond to advocates, alongside sometimes a lack of understanding of what the role of the advocate is, leading to some tensions between service providers, advocates, and indeed the individuals that the advocate was working with. There were some individuals within reviews who did not engage with advocates, and there perhaps advocates face the same challenges that sometimes practitioners face, which is how to respond to individuals who do not engage, and what skills we can bring to such situations. And there were examples where, as I've already highlighted, family members or staff were used as advocates, and there were concerns expressed in safeguarding adult reviews about that. But equally, there were some reviews where no concerns were expressed about the use of family or staff as advocates, which I suspect you may find disappointing. I would find disappointing, because an independent advocate is there for a reason, and that reason is independence. There were recommendations made within reviews about advocacy. They're on the right-hand side of the slide, so it won't be as a surprise to you to note that there were recommendations that advocacy should be considered as a matter of routine, and that advocates should be involved and their roles, responsibilities, and remits understood and reflected, respected. That commissioners should review, along with safeguarding adult boards, the adequacy of supply, and indeed the effectiveness of advocacy and the use of advocacy when services are commissioned. There was less attention than I was expecting as to whether we should have separate advocacy providers for mental health, mental capacity, care and support, domestic violence, or whether commissioners should be commissioning one organisation to supply advocacy across the different legislative provisions. And those of you in the room today may have views about the pros and cons of different options there. Next slide, please, Francis. Overall, and not just specifically in relation to advocacy, the report made a number of recommendations for sector-led improvement for the enhancement of services. Those recommendations have been subdivided into five areas, and AD, myself, others involved in the research, alongside the National Network of Chairs of Safeguarding Adult Boards, staff in the Department of Health and Social Care, sector leaders in the Local Government Association and in ADAS, we'll be working together to address the priorities that we have identified as a result of the review. Next slide, please, Francis. Those are my contact details. Next slide, please, Francis. The key questions that I identified when I was reflecting on this presentation do not derive explicitly from the national analysis, the findings of which I have just reported. But they are questions that occur to me, not least because I've read the insight report that AD presented, heard AD present it before, and also because as a member of the National Network of Safeguarding Adult Board Chairs, we have focused in some detail on the impact of Lockdown 1 and Lockdown 2, not least on residents in care homes, not least on discharges from hospital. And we continue to focus on that. And so I reflected on all of that and put together some questions which you may want to focus on as part of whatever time we have left for questions and discussion. Thank you. That's it from me. Happy to hand back, Judith, to you.
That's brilliant. Thank you. My goodness, such insight from both our speakers. Absolutely amazing. It would be remiss of me if I did not take the chair's privilege to just to share with people the fact that there has been a national advocacy survey nationwide, well, across the England and Wales, about the issues that we've come across during COVID. There's an incredible report that talks about, you know, safeguarding. It talks about the human rights abuses we've seen. It talks about all that kind of stuff. So it's in your resource pack that went out ahead of time. So please do look at that and come back to me or any of the other agencies that are part of that if you want to talk about that. I also think, you know, again, taking chair's privilege and sitting in, you know, being part of the advocacy sector, you know, particularly your presentation, Michael, you've talked a lot about the supply of advocacy. And I think as advocacy organisations, although it's statutory, and if you're eligible under statute, you should receive that service. I think we've all seen situations in which there have been waiting lists and other forms of prioritisation, which kind of sit uncomfortably. But since COVID, you know, the pressures that local authorities as you know, CCGs as commissioners of advocacy are under are even greater. And, you know, I know that we are in a number of other organisations across the country and in Wales are seeing real kind of pressures on what can be funded. And as I say, that kind of sits uncomfortably with a statutory entitlement, providing you meet the eligibility of that. So I just wanted to kind of say that. The chat function is absolutely on fire, absolutely on fire. So thank you both. I don't know that we've got probably half an hour, so we'll do as many as we can, but probably as we did with AD's last talk, Michael, AD, if we're not able to get through all the questions, perhaps offline we can work on what responses to those questions might be and then get that out to attendees and colleagues that couldn't be here today, as well as an updated resource list. But just picking, you know, some of the things in the chat function. Blimey, you know, we've got 35, I think, messages now, but I'm just going to do my best to pick. So if we can't answer everything, bear with us. We'll get back to you afterwards. So is discharging people from hospital to care homes a safeguarding issue? And I know AD spoke about this before, but it's come up again several times. So I think it's worth revisiting that. So perhaps, I don't know if you both want to comment or...
I'm happy to start on that. Yeah. I mean, I think what I said last time, it can be. It can be. I think what the data shows, which is helpful in terms of some of the other questions about care homes and safeguarding, is that during the lockdown period, for the information that we've got until June, the increase in the number of concerns from people in their own homes and the decrease from people in institutional and residential homes and in nursing homes does validate the concerns people have that there were less reports from care home settings, and it putting what, you know, two and two together, the lack of access for families, friends, but also professionals, advocates, has meant that there is very clear evidence of decreased reporting. So that's a valid, as it were, concern by the sector that's evidenced in the data in the Insight report. Mm-hmm. On an individual level, the discharge of anyone from a hospital to a care home setting can be a safeguarding issue for all sorts of reasons. And indeed, there are, I think, safeguarding adult reviews that have that as a feature, if I'm not wrong, Michael. So it can be. I think that the tricky issue is whether the policy implementation in the early part of COVID was a safeguarding issue, has been discussed at the Safeguarding Adult Board's chairs at that time and ongoingly. And that's a more, that's taking it at a policy level as opposed to that individual safeguarding personal level. But Michael, do add.
Well, not unusually. I'll start by agreeing with you. So my answer is the same as AD's. It can be an adult safeguarding issue. There are reviews that have focused very critically on hospital discharge processes. And I've no doubt that in reviews currently being commissioned or to be commissioned in the future, at least in part because of the pandemic, will also conclude that in certain instances, hospital discharges have fallen short of best practice. I can certainly think of some examples within the national analysis where reviewers were very critical of discharge processes. I think any transition, whether it's from hospital to care home, hospital to home, home into care home, prison into the community, any transition has the potential to be an opportunity, but it also has, unfortunately, the potential to be a cliff edge. And all of us have a responsibility to turn transitions into an opportunity rather than a cliff edge. And sadly, we don't always demonstrate that. I went through a transition when I retired from full-time academic life. It's known as a transition into retirement. I am still trying to deal with it, which is perhaps why I'm now an adult safeguarding consultant and haven't retired. But, you know, you get the sense. Transitions for all of us are enormously important, and they can either go well or they can either go badly. And we've all got an opportunity to ensure that they go as well as possible.
And picking up on concerns that, you know, we have as an organisation, but I can see from the chat function, it's a common concern, and it's kind of around the lack of access. And as Michael and AD and I were discussing, was it last week, and I mentioned a bit at the beginning, although maybe the issues are not fundamentally different, since COVID, that lack of access, that lack of being able to get in and see people in the way that we used to, I think we're all finding quite uncomfortable, quite stressful, and a real worry. You know, many RPR, what used to be visits, are now phone calls. And, you know, we all, you know, hand on heart, do the best that we can with that. And, you know, we talk to as many people as we can, and we try and build up the best picture that we can. But it's not the same as being there and speaking to that person. So I think as an advocacy sector, we're all feeling that it's kind of not okay, and we don't know quite what to do about it, where to take it. Obviously, you know, we've done this national survey, and we're trying to you know, lobby health and social care around that. But I can see from the chat function that there's a real worry about this. So whether AD, Michael, you've both been talking about best practice and some of the innovation that you've seen, is there anything that you can share that would kind of help us and help everyone else on this call in terms of how to do this better?
Well, something got into, if I start this time, and AD can either agree or contradict me. But as you were speaking, Judith, a thought dropped into my mind, which I have to confess before today I hadn't thought of. And that is that a decent care home will recognise that just as it is important as we go through lockdown two and whatever restrictions follow, to ensure that family members have as much access to a care home resident as it is possible to facilitate in advance of a vaccine and subsequent to a vaccine, so that good care home provider will recognise that an advocate should have the same facility, the same access, because an advocate is very often there, or is usually there, either when there is no one else who can support a person, or when there are other people to support a person, but where people in that environment are not of one view about what is in somebody's best interests.
In an end of life situation. Yes.
So I think, for those of us like AD and myself who occasionally have opportunities to make representations to civil servants in the Department of Health and Social Care, for example, that we should actually be saying, you know what, when you're thinking about facilitating access into care homes, don't forget advocates.
Oh, because, bless you. Thank you. Wow.
So insofar as I can do that, I will do that. But maybe you as an advocacy alliance organisation can also use the opportunities you have to say, both in advance of the vaccine and subsequent to it, advocates need to be treated alongside family members and alongside care staff as in the front line for access to residents in care homes, and indeed in other settings, not just in care homes.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely.
So I do agree, of course, with Michael. I think there's two things I'd add. One is that visiting policies are shifting, not least because of challenges from a human rights perspective. And certainly in the last few days, even couple of weeks, I've seen a lot of shift around moving from a real challenge around blanket, no visiting approaches, a much more personalised approach, particularly around, for example, end of life care. And I think that provides at least the potential for a shift in the approach that may be taken towards advocates visiting the resident who's living in the care home and being more flexible and being personalised to their needs. If they need an advocate, then I would have assumed that that should be a priority. So that's one thing I would note, that there has been a real shift recently in terms of visiting guidance and advice, and that's to be welcomed. So there's a bit of an open door, if you excuse the pun, around that. The second thing I'd say, and this is from being the chair of the Safeguarding Adults Board, in terms of asking other partners who are members of the board, what's the difference between the learning, what's the learning and the difference in practice between the first lockdown and the second lockdown, that across the board, there are partners who are saying, we are being far more responsive and nuanced and flexible in our approach to accessing our services. So where in the first lockdown, and I think we have to remember back to how awful it was in March and how much we were, everybody didn't know how infectious COVID was. And so it was a real time of fear and anxiety. And so many services literally closed their doors, did everything online. I think I've noticed in the reports from partners at boards that there's been a real shift in terms of, again, a more flexible, nuanced, risk-assessed approach, that there's more face-to-face, particularly around safeguarding. In fact, one partner has said very clearly that they really emphasize face-to-face contact for safeguarding inquiries now, obviously protecting the staff, having the right PPE, which we didn't have back in March and April. So I think in that sense, there's also a real shift in practice from assuming everything needs to be virtual and online to being a more nuanced, risk assessed in all sorts of ways, balancing the risks to the person, the risks to staff, and so on. Approach this. In particular, for example, we mustn't forget some of the safeguarding risks where people have refused access themselves because they were frightened
of
infection. And, you know, some very inevitable, natural, understandable responses in terms of rejecting help and support. So I think there has been a real shift on both those fronts, which then allows some space for advocacy and advocates to have a foot in the door, literally, in terms of a different approach to accessing face-to-face contact with the people who they're working with. And I would encourage advocate organisations locally to be in contact with their commissioners and with their partners around pushing that forward.
Yeah, really helpful. Thank you both. That's, yeah, really helpful. One here from Ian. Would a situation where a DOLS authorisation has expired and there's a delay to a new authorisation because of COVID-related things, so therefore the person is unlawfully detained, would that constitute safeguarding?
Yes.
AD?
Sorry, I was on mute. Michael's a legal expert here. He teaches.
Okay,
to teach
fine.
It.
I'm going with Michael. You wanted to add.
I think, I suppose what I would say again, and I'd say this as a chair of boards as opposed to my role in the Care and Health Improvement Programme, is that I have been assured by statutory agencies that they're really on top of their DOLS work and that that's a real priority. So in that role, I'm assured for both the boards that I work with that type of circumstance wouldn't occur. And I think it, particularly with the issues around the lockdown and COVID about some of the inappropriate measures that might have been taken in the first lockdown, this is quite a sensitive area and quite complex. And I do note that the Department of Health and Social Care have issued and reissued a number of times guidance in this area, reflecting the changes in understanding regarding the COVID-related implications. So I'm not professing to be an expert in this area, but I can see that there has been some shifts in how the advice and policy has moved on over the period of time in response to COVID.
Yeah, thank you. We've got a question here. Can we get a brief outline of the advocacy process? Because I'm confused about how one is appointed or how to refer. So what I suggest we do, it's a great question. I think we can take that offline. AD, I know some of the work that's been done by City and Hackney Safeguarding Adults Board. There's some flowcharts there in terms of the safeguarding process, how advocacy sits with that, how health complaints sits with that. So with your permission, with Raina's permission, and we can talk about that afterwards, perhaps we can make those flowcharts available?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's really helpful. So that's a really good one. Right, oh gosh, we've got, we're never going to get through all these. We've got 26, it was probably 36 messages still there that we've not got to, and we've got about 10 more minutes. So I think we're going to have to do that thing at some point. We'll do a couple more questions, and then if people can bear with us, we will download the chat afterwards, and we will come back and respond to all of them. So one here, are people aware of the latest government instructions regarding discharge? Don't know what the answer to that is, but I guess as professionals, whatever our role is, we need to be making sure that we know whatever the government instructions are in relation to discharge or anything else.
Yeah, which highlights, Judith, the point that the AD's just made in relation to DOLS and mental capacity more generally, that the government, particularly the Department of Health and Social Care, issues and reissues guidance as a result of the Coronavirus Act 2020 and the relaxations that it made in particular areas. And what adjustments the government regards as reasonable, for example, in Mental Capacity Act practice. But it's important to emphasise that there has been no easements, no relaxation in relation to adult safeguarding.
Or advocacy.
Or indeed advocacy. So, clearly the onus is on every advocacy organisation to be as up to speed as it can be with government guidance as it emerges.
Absolutely. Right, just flicking through. Is it neglect or inappropriate treatment of a patient, service user, resident, whatever our terminology is it neglect or inappropriate treatment by relying solely on phone or video consultation? And if so, is that a safeguarding issue?
Well, if I go back to before we'd ever heard of COVID-19 and think about and focus on what is in the statutory guidance that accompanies the CARE Act and what the statutory guidance says about care and support assessments under Section 9 of the CARE Act, it says that serious consideration must be given to whether a telephone assessment is adequate in the circumstances of each unique case. In other words, for, if you like, very simple assessments, a telephone assessment may be sufficient. But for more complex situations where a more nuanced understanding is necessary, a telephone assessment will not be sufficient. And I don't think that guidance should be any different now that we're in a pandemic.
No.
There will be occasions when one can get a reasonable assessment as a result of a telephone interaction. But there will be other occasions when you cannot do that. And indeed, talking to my father last week after he'd had a TIA, and I'm on the phone and asking him, you know, whether he can manage and so forth. And he tries to pull the wool over my eyes and says, of course he can manage.
Yeah.
You know? And then the voice of my sister pipes up in the background and says, rubbish. Well, you know, had she not been there and had I chosen to rely on his self-reporting over the telephone, I would have got an inaccurate assessment of his situation. So there will be situations where telephone assessment is not good enough. How one then responds to that in the context of a pandemic is something that obviously has to be worked through. But if there is sufficient PPE and other protective measures ahead of a vaccine, then clearly a face-to-face assessment or a virtual face-to-face assessment should seriously be considered. Telephone assessment may not be adequate.
And building on that, as one for you, AD here, what would your advice be in relation to safeguarding where different family members disagree about what the risks are, what the issues are, and what the way forward is, and who is acting in whose best interest?
I would say nothing's changed. We had those problems before COVID, and I don't think that changes the dynamics don't change. And that's a very familiar scenario where different family members have different opinions about what the right thing is to do, not least the person themselves. And I think that there is improved understanding of the limitations of some of the virtual mechanisms that people have been using, and so certainly advice and support has been issued in different professions. Somebody was telling me recently about GPs being given advice around making sure, how do you know if someone's being unduly influenced by someone else in the room or in the house, and more awareness of the ways in which when telephone or virtual conversations are going on and you're not physically with somebody. I think that how you mitigate those risks, because those are risks that you have to mitigate, being aware of them and then working out how to mitigate against them, which may involve asking different questions like, are you alone, is there anyone else there? Which, you know, still somebody can lie and say, no, I'm by myself, and actually somebody's hanging over them. But I think it's an area for ongoing learning. And I'll go back to my earlier point about COVID, the pandemic. The response to the pandemic is unprecedented, certainly in my lifetime. I've never experienced anything like this in my working life, and I'm probably one of the oldest people in this call. I won't say how old I am, but I am probably one of them. And I think we have to recognize that we're in, to some extent, uncharted territory, and people are doing the best they can and learning as they go along. And that that has to be acknowledged and recognized. So in terms of how do you manage those conversations where you've got different family members with different views about what should be the right thing to do and what is in someone's best interest, inevitably, as always, require a huge amount of skill and sensitivity to arrive at an outcome that's the right outcome for that person, taking on board the interests of various different family members in their network or their friends, if a network is there. So I do think it's, in some respects, it always has been like this. However, how we do it, it's the how that's changed. And it is very challenging and it is very difficult. And not being able to physically see somebody in a neutral place does present real challenges. So I don't want to underestimate that, but I also want to say that understanding, and there's some chat at the moment around next of kin and, you know, the whole area of how to encourage people to make the right arrangements about who can operate in their interests and not relying on a very woolly next of kin, label is so important, within this context. I don't want to get too technical about powers of attorney and all of the stuff that we could go into, but those tools have been there, continue to be there, and should be encouraged for people to make explicit what their wishes are should they be unable to make decisions on their for themselves. That doesn't change. What changes is how we help people to do that. And I don't want to underestimate that barrier, the barriers that exist at the moment and the difficulties we have in facing them. But it is unprecedented what we're doing. And some of it, some of it is helpful learning and some of it is really challenging and will continue to be challenging.
I'd just like to add a little to what Adi has said, all of which I agree with. It's what you do when your best skills and your best efforts fail to resolve a disagreement between family members or between family members and practitioners, or indeed between practitioners. If there is a lasting power of attorney involved and you're concerned about how the lasting power of attorney is exercising their responsibilities, a referral to the Office of the Public Guardian is absolutely essential, because the Office of the Public Guardian has a responsibility to ensure that that attorneys are exercising their powers appropriately. In the event of a disagreement which cannot be resolved, then a referral to the Court of Protection is indicated. And advocates should be pushing for that through the local authority or clinical commissioning group. And there have been safeguarding adult reviews where referrals have not been made to the Court of Protection and have not been made to the Office of the Public Guardian. And essentially, therefore, disputes have been left unresolved, which is in nobody's best interests, and certainly not the service user or patient's best interests. So it's about following things through to their logical conclusion when your best efforts as advocates have not resolved. The other thing I would say in relation to people who may be engaging with advocates but still have decisional capacity in particular areas, is that we all need to think very seriously about making lasting powers of attorney for when we might need them, and making advanced directives for when we might need them, if we need them. Those are some very simple steps that all of us of a certain age, and perhaps those of us not yet of a certain age, and I'm 69, incidentally, AD, I'm not bashful about my age. There are some steps that all of us can take, and there may be occasions actually when advocates can explore with people whether they feel ready to make those particular steps.
Well, thank you both. We're at time now. There's still 55 new messages on chat. So it just shows how engaged everyone is with this as a subject matter, which is absolutely fantastic. So as I've said a couple of times, we will go through the chat function. We'll pull out key questions and I'll liaise with Michael and AD, and we'll put out a Q&A document afterwards that we can add to the resource list. Because I think that helps everyone. But just to say, thank you everyone for joining, and particularly thank you to AD and Michael, being absolutely fantastic and really inspirational. And, let's hope we can keep this energy going and, move things forward.